At this point, what we'd like to do actually is ask one of the respondents to make some comments. I had mentioned that we had invited five people to be with us today, people that we have had relationships with over the years, to actually speak from their own experience as organizers, as artists, as researchers, to talk about some of the questions that have been raised. And I'd like to begin with David Thorne, actually, if I could. Fantastic. Look, that's a happy face. So here I come, and I bring the microphone to Mr. Thorne. Is this good? Yes.
David has brought treats, dessert.
Chewy candy.
Straight from Canal Street?
Rivington Street. Economy candy. Well, I'm a little bit on the spot, but I guess rather than making any kind of extended comments or referring to my own practice, maybe I'll just try to reintroduce into the discussion a couple things that came up over the course of the presentations, and actually also maybe as a starting point. I think your name is Sharon, is that right? You said something about, who spoke first? There was a question in the early part of the presentations that had to do with artists identifying either as activists or organizers, and that question raised a question for me as an artist who identifies as neither, and just identifies as an artist, about my position in relationship to social movements. Activism, organizing, and I feel like I work from a place of allegiances and alliances and alignments, and not through explicit identifications, either as an organizer or an activist. So this just puts a question, again, out for general discussion about how that works in relationship to what you all sort of laid out, which was a couple of very precise positions about what, in a way, almost imperatives about what art should be in relationship to organizing, which I find somewhat problematic, I started to find it problematic at the beginning of the whole series of presentations. By the end, I'm feeling like it's less problematic because I see within UltraRed's practice a kind of diversity of conceptions of that. So anyway, that's just a general comment. So.
Do you want to respond to the respondent?
I have no idea what respondent.
Okay. I thought so. That was a trick, right, David? Distract everyone. Thank you, Noam.
Okay, so candies are being passed around, rappers drowning out the speaker.
Okay, I have a question. David, what do you think was slightly problematic? Maybe you should explain this.
Just the sort of the position that art either does this or that it needs to have a utilitarian kind of function within the context of organizing or activism or politics, and that work that is taking place maybe outside of those particular parameters is somehow not considerable. Even work that's within the institutions of art, which is actually where some of this work exists too. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe we should, I think many people in this room can respond to this. And perhaps we should defer. I mean, Sharon, perhaps this is a question, you know, that you'd actually like to respond to. I'd kind of rather hear from other people before I go.
Would you like to?
Well, yeah, I like what you said about allegiances and alliances, and I could just sort of explain what my practice is and why this is an issue for me, because I don't feel myself to be an organizer in the sense that you were posing. I also don't feel myself to be an activist in the sense that you were posing, because my engagements are sustained. But I'm not a part of the communities that I work with, because they're incarcerated women and injection drug users. But I don't think I have to be an injection drug user or a formerly incarcerated woman to engage it with those individuals and their groups. And I'm interested in promoting their political subjectivity. But I'm not an organizer. I work within organizations with people who I consider to be organizers, whose, you know, practice is political organizing. So I think it's just an interesting discussion to have about what is the space that you occupy in an art practice that is, you know, attempting to engage the public sphere, issues of citizenship and agency, and you know, I don't have a conclusion about that. I didn't hear anyone here saying that that it was necessary to do this in order to be making art. But it seems like all the people who are here are people who are interested in doing this and having it be a part of an art practice. So I think that's...
Mm-hmm. Chan, is this a question that you'd like to respond to? I mean, many of us who do engaged work, we're often sort of immediately written into a discussion that we think we had never brought up. I many times am immediately responded to, Emily knows this story well, immediately responded to with, oh, you're saying that all art needs to be moral. Morality? Who brought up morality, you know? Or you're saying that, right, so there's immediately this, you're immediately inscribed into a discussion that you think you have nothing to do with, but because of the terms and the way that the field is so resolved in certain, around these issues, and they come with such intense historical baggage, that trying to on a practical level do your work is really really difficult. And I guess for me, what I often find as I'm very interested in thinking about what the aesthetic can do, and not because I think organizing doesn't do it, but because I think organizing already does that. Organizing is already employing aesthetic decisions. And as soon as you're going to talk about activating people's emotional responses to their state of being, you're already entering into the realm of the aesthetic, I think. And so I'm not needed for that to happen. But perhaps, as an artist, what you can bring to that discussion is further consideration of it. And in the same way that Manuela was talking about, what then does the organizer do if the subject is already engaged in the practice of making their politics, then you're not about raising consciousness. I think that's a really, really useful distinction in this case. So then what is your practice? Well, then your practice is about facilitating connections. Your practice is about highlighting what is already occurring. So when decisions are being made, we're going to have a march, and the march is going to be a political, a militant march, but it's going to be a funeral march. Right? That's that. So much has just happened. So much has just happened. That is an engagement on the level of the aesthetic, an engagement on the level of procedure, duration, you know, all of the things that we see as part of a kind of conceptual or progressive art practice, right? So am I needed for that? No, I'm not needed for that. But there may be some things that that I can contribute. And I think one of the things that working with Leonardo and Elizabeth, and working with other people, and then my own sort of political sphere, is that perhaps one of the things that art can do, okay, if we're going to go there, and one of the things that art can do is to hold off for a minute this quick rush to the campaign. Let's just not go there yet. Now, you know, Freire and popular education is all about not going there yet. It's all about putting in process and putting in place very methodical procedures. And it's not the organizers determining what the campaign is. The campaign comes out of a discussion on reflection on experiences, followed by analysis, followed by a plan of action. And it is not the organizer saying, I'm going to organize this group for the campaign. But you know what? Popular education has become this. It has. In the same way that political art has been bastardized in so many ways, so it's about making posters, so has popular education been bastardized and employed for the purposes of, you know, coercing people into a predetermined campaign. Perhaps this is where we can intervene, is to hold off going there, and let's go through the work of reflecting on our anxieties, reflecting on our fears, reflecting on our joys, reflecting on our differences, developing analysis from that, and then a plan of action.
Can you share and reflect a little bit on why you choose the medium of sound? Like, why, if you're talking about aesthetics, what is interesting to you about the language, the possibilities Sure. of sound that you choose to use that aesthetic form? Yes. And I'm interested in sound because I think we live in a very visually saturated landscape, so it's really interesting to insert something that isn't visual.
Let me take some time here because I think this might be useful for all of us, for those of us who've been with Ultra Red from the beginning and those of us who are new to this place. In the beginning, the mission statement for Ultra Red was a sort of investigate, and I'll try to if I remember the exact words, an investigation into acoustic space as an enunciation of social relations. Right. Don't you love that China shit? I just love that. Yes, so an investigation into acoustic space as an enunciation of social relations. And there are many ways that we and other people, lots of other people, have done this. This is not our only, we're not the only ones doing this. Many people do this, right? So looking at how legal instruments are developed around sound, right? So the difference between city ordinances around loudness, which are all about private property, versus city ordinances around occupational health, right? And they don't line up. Right, so you have to struggle for the ones that talk about occupational safety, and trust me, there aren't that many that talk about sound, but there's a lot of them that are about private property. Right, so there you got some social relations going on big time. Right, so then about silence. Think about silence. Okay, for a moment, let's put Cage to the side where, you know, maybe he belongs. So, you know, how often do we enjoy silence? And who has access to silence? Who has access to it? And does this make some sort of, does this suggest somehow social relations? Then there's a matter of sound and how sound is used to territorialize. We all know this. We've all seen Do the Right Thing. We've all seen the Spike Lee movie. We don't need to talk. So that's another example. Okay. So these kinds of discussions have been things that that we have pursued. I think each of us in our presentations here have sort of articulated what sound affords, and precisely maybe along the lines that you're thinking. You know, it's this other realm that we don't necessarily have a facility to talk about, so it presents a kind of, you know, unresolved sphere of experience. It's funny, whenever you talk about sound, there's always going to be someone who says, what about smell? No, you laugh, but it's true. And it's always because there's this idea that once we leave the visual regime, we've lost the symbolic. We are out into some, like, no, there's no orientation, so let's bring in smell. What about taste? What about, right? So I think it's not a matter of all the senses lined up. I think it's a matter of vision and the others. But regardless, I'm interested in sound. I'm also interested in how many of us who do cinema and who do film and video, how often our discussions of film and video ignore the fact that the spatializing technology within video film is the sound. The image is a flat, two-dimensional screen. It's the sound that creates the spatial relations and arrangements. It is your interaction with balance. You know, you got two ears, they're connected to your equilibrium, it's all about, okay. So the production of space is the sound, it's not the image. In fact, there was a huge debate and concern in early film theory that if you were going to edit sound, you had to do sound just like you would experience it, because sound was just going to be like, was going to make everyone throw up. So there was all this concern about distances of voices, how far, like if the character is far away and speaking, then the voice has to be far away. And then they realized that it doesn't work that way, that people actually demanded the voice to be up close, even if the character was far off screen, far in the background. So the whole, okay, all that stuff. But I think, bringing Cage back into the room, I think one of the things that Cage allows us to think about, and again, going back to silence, is that silence is actually, there is no such thing. Only dead people experience silence. It's not an accident that the dead room, the anechoic chamber that Cage enters in 1951 at Harvard, the dead room is where he hears his body, the high frequency of the nervous system, the low frequency of the circulatory system. And that is the 0 degree. That is the base of all acoustic experience. You can't escape that. So then what is silence? Silence is a category of knowledge. It is something that is constructed, right? So it is this thing. So it is silencing, it is a verb, right? All these things, you know, oh, those voices have been silenced. Well, then let's begin to ask that. When we're thinking about silence, right? And this is the big, you know, come on, you know, act up. Silence equals death. This raises all sorts of questions, because for Cage, silence did not equal death. Silence actually equaled the basic experience that makes things possible. It's only in silence that you can hear. And what does Paulo Freire say? Freire says that silence is the condition for listening, and that as a teacher, invested in radical understanding and radical knowledge, what is the role of the teacher? The role of the teacher is to be silent. The role of the teacher is to be quiet, because it is precisely in your silence that the desire of the other exists. Freire said that, not Lacan. Freire said that. So there's a whole realm that is available to us as organizers, I think. We talk so much about the voice. We want to have the others, the voice of the other heard, the voice. Well, what does that mean precisely? And what does it mean for the voice? Is the voice not being heard if we don't make it heard? What does that mean? And why is it that, you know, authenticity in this way, you know, all we can debate these things forever. But this is why, because of a whole range of issues that sound affords us around political subjectivity, the relationship between the subject and space, and desire. Is that too long? I'm sorry. See, I write, I should write, and then... So we've sort of remained here in the front, not that we need to be the continued focus of our discussion. And it is, you know, the questions have been raised as a part of the first part of the discussion, but I suspect that other questions exist within this room that maybe we're not the best ones to answer. And so I would like, as a teacher, to shut up.